Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Japanese corruption scandal that's threatening Shinzo Abe's premiership. Reuters reported on a poll earlier this week which revealed that almost half of the country thinks that he should resign, following the revelation that his government sold state land to a nationalist school operator who supposedly has ties with his wife. And although the prime minister apologized for how the situation has shaken public trust in the whole administration, he refused to recognize that he did anything wrong. The scandal runs the risk of complicating what would have otherwise been Abe's almost guaranteed re-election as the Liberal Democratic Party's leader in September, to say nothing of throwing into doubt his long-held dream of eventually revising the country's post-war pacifist constitution. Despite the growing public anger directed at him because of the scandal, Abe will probably be loath to admit that he broke the law, let alone stand down because of it, due to his strong personality and willingness to hold out until the very end, no matter what. This leadership trait of boldly defying all odds is something that he has in common with his Russian and American peers, both of whom he's built up a substantial groundswell of personal rapport with that he's now trying to leverage to Japan's advantage. As regards Russia, Abe wants to resolve what his country refers to as the Kuril Islands dispute, and enter into an economic partnership with the resource-rich and geostrategically positioned neighboring country, while his vision for America has to do with strengthening the lead-from-behind partnership between the two as Washington pushes Tokyo to become a key player in the so-called China Containment Coalition, formerly known as the Quad, and rise to the occasion of supporting the U.S. amidst its developing trade war against the People's Republic. These seemingly contradictory but not mutually incompatible foreign policy goals could be endangered if Abe's government collapses as a result of this corruption scandal, with the regional geopolitical repercussions being far-reaching if the island nation's caretaker government reverts back to its previous post-war tendencies of indecisiveness, timidity, and introversion. This could indefinitely halt the Russian-Japanese rapprochement and neutralize the country's anti-Chinese proxy effectiveness in the new Cold War, which, while being a relative setback for Moscow and Washington for completely different reasons, would nevertheless be a breakthrough for Beijing because it would essentially neutralize one of China's most dangerous strategic competitors. The next one up is the recently ratified military agreement between the U.S. and Ghana. The deal essentially turns the West African country into an American military garrison because it allows the Pentagon full transit and basing rights for its troops and contractors, protects them with immunity from local prosecution for any suspected crimes that they commit on Ghanaian soil, and exempts all equipment imports from taxes, thereby making it a much more robust version of the 2016 Lamoa Pact with India that solidified the military strategic partnership between those two states. This sweeping move also represents a complete reversal from the days of anti-imperialist hero Kwame Nkrumah, who led Ghana to independence in 1957 as the first post-colonial country in Africa. Instead of embracing the non-aligned movement that the country itself helped found over half a century ago, Ghana's contemporary leadership apparently believes that it should partner up with the U.S. in the new Cold War, irrespective of the geopolitical and domestic consequences. The U.S.'s interest in Ghana stems from the country's relative stability as an island of peace in a region largely beset by terrorist attacks and rebel insurgencies, with it being all the more attractive of a partner due to its dual mainland maritime position in being a backdoor to the Sahel region via its northern neighbor Burkina Faso, while simultaneously boasting a long shoreline along the Gulf of Guinea in near proximity to Africa's largest economy and most populous state of Nigeria. These two geostrategic factors combine to make Ghana the U.S.'s future West African hub for regional military operations, whether they're openly directed against Daesh and related groups in the northern scrubland, or clandestinely focused on the destabilization of Nigeria if it behaves too independently and moves closer to China. Furthermore, Ghana is a convenient staging point for any missions in the smaller but mineral-rich and war-torn coastal countries to the west. What's most troubling about all of this, however, is that Ghana and its people aren't really slated to receive anything in return, apart from the national military partaking in joint exercises with their American counterparts, something that they were already doing before this anyhow. Furthermore, the RAND Corporation published a report last month that basically proved the correlation between U.S. military deployments abroad and the occurrence of hybrid war in whichever region it is that American troops are sent to, suggesting that this latest move might actually destabilize West Africa more than the reverse, and potentially even lead to unexpected asymmetrical blowback within Ghana's own borders. Even if events don't play out according to this dark scenario, then it's still difficult to imagine what tangible benefits the Pentagon will bring to Ghana and its people, making it seem like their geography is being exploited in exchange for nothing at all. Third on our countdown is Malaysia mulling criminal punishment for people who spread fake news. A proposed law would allow for a maximum sentence of 10 years in jail and or over $110,000 in fines for people who are found guilty of spreading fake news, which is defined in the legislation as news, information, data, or reports which is or are wholly or partly false, and which Reuters notes also includes features, visuals, and audio recordings. Some people are concerned because of the partly false clause that vaguely leaves everything open to the authorities' broad interpretation and potential abuse in suppressing legitimate political dissent, which is all the more relevant in Malaysia's domestic political context because of an ongoing corruption scandal that threatens the incumbent government ahead of forthcoming elections in the future. One of the points that's worrying about this proposal and any copycats that might spring up abroad afterwards is that it doesn't specify what's meant by publishing the so-called fake news, meaning that the punitive terms contained within the draft could possibly be directed against people who share controversial links on social media or even just react to them and inadvertently prompt the platform's algorithm to make their interaction pop up on other people's news feeds. Another issue is that the suggested law doesn't differentiate between reporting, commentary, and analysis, three interconnected media and journalistic topics that are oftentimes wrongly conflated with one another, like in this case. Openly false news that's deceptively reported as true and designed to provoke physical reactions from the public, such as protest, violent riots, flag and effigy burnings, and other such behavior, is weaponized information in a form of hybrid warfare. But opinionated commentary and deep analysis are natural reactions to events of relevant domestic and international political importance, the diversity of which is a hallmark of a democratic state so long as it's well-intended and within the bounds of legality and proper social standards. Peaceful dissent in a wide range of respectable discourse should be tolerated. Otherwise, governments will drive individuals underground and into potential contact with extremist and terrorist groups via a political version of the so-called gateway theory. The most effective means for clarifying misleading narratives and counteracting the inaccurate ones is through fact-checkers, which could be affiliated with the government either directly or through state sponsorship of pertinent NGOs, or GONGOs, and who would then disseminate their counter-narratives through mainstream and alternative medias. The stifling of free speech by de facto intimidating people from expressing politically incorrect commentary under the basis of combating fake news, no matter if this is the state's deliberate intent or not, will inevitably exacerbate domestic tensions inside any society with time. So governments such as Malaysia's must exercise the utmost caution in proceeding with their proposed plans. Our runner-up is 44 African nations signing the Continental Free Trade Agreement last week in Rwanda. The treaty must now be ratified at the national level by either 15 or 22 of its members, a number which is still being decided upon, in order to enter into effect, which the African Union expects to be officially promulgated within the next 6 months. The CFTA is widely seen as being a precursor to an African version of the EU, but the regional East African Community Bloc's pre-existing hesitancy in enhancing its members' comprehensive integration into a federation foreshadows some of the continent's future problems in this respect, though amplified to the highest degree given the much larger number of countries involved. Although designed to deepen intra-African trade, the CFTA might unintentionally exacerbate economic disparities between its members, which could potentially even lead to intracontinental neocolonial relations between some of them. For example, more developed economies could easily flood their lesser developed neighbors with cheap manufactured goods. And since the agreement has no vision for improving capacity building within states, it's entirely foreseeable that the weaker ones might end up surrendering their economic sovereignty. This could in turn lead to economic specialization within countries and regions that hampers their diversification policies, but nevertheless makes the entire continent more attractive to foreign investors, such as the former European colonizers, China, America, India, Japan, and even Turkey, because it could now become reconceptualized as a single, interconnected economic space. Accordingly, the role of regional integrational blocs might increase in the interim as different parts of Africa jockey for leading positions in this continental framework and seek to woo more Silk Road and Asia-Africa Growth Corridor investment. Importantly, African leaders Nigeria and South Africa abstain from agreeing to this arrangement out of concern for its far-reaching implications, which could one day entail efforts to unveil a common currency and even remove national borders in order to enable the free movement of labor. This latter concern could lead to looming socio-cultural challenges within Africa's largest and most diverse states, because their populations may not react positively to the influx of poor individuals from elsewhere streaming into their countries and competing with them for jobs. South Africa already has a well-known xenophobic problem that would only get much worse if so-called weapons of mass migration uncontrollably swarmed into its borders, and other leading countries such as Nigeria might experience the same in the near future too. Contrary to the lingering and incorrect stereotype of some kind of homogeneous African culture, no such thing objectively exists, just as it doesn't for Europe, Asia, or anywhere else, due to each continent's tremendous diversity. And any perceived, keyword, threat to the established way of life that a nation has charted since independence might engender a domestic political reaction. It's therefore possible that the CFTA could become a potent election issue. Though because of the comparatively lesser independence of African states and their population's mostly non-Western political culture, large-scale dissent and protest might not develop around this issue right away, except maybe in a few countries like South Africa and Nigeria. Another forward-looking factor to focus on is that peripheral conflicts might pose a higher hybrid war risk to an interconnected Africa than one that hasn't yet integrated, which could be a security vulnerability if countries don't proactively respond to these scenarios, but also an opportunity for them to multilaterally do so because of it. At our top spot, we've got Abdel Fattah el-Sisi likely being re-elected as president of Egypt. The former military man's victory isn't in doubt, and he can rest assured that he will probably get the mandate needed to continue carrying out his domestic and foreign policies. The first one is all about solidifying his country's post-coup political system, drawing in international investment, and strengthening security. Daesh has suddenly appeared in the Sinai and has yet to be completely wiped out by the Egyptian armed forces, which is why Israel reportedly conducted over 100 airstrikes there over the past 2 years in coordination with Cairo. As for the economic component of President Sisi's strategy, he wants to take advantage of his country's crucial geostrategic transit position astride European-Chinese Silk Road trade in order to draw more foreign investors into the Suez Canal economic zone and thenceforth into the rest of the world's most populous Arab country. The billions of dollars of aid that Egypt has received from the Gulf states since the 2013 coup has made President Sisi indebted to the Arab monarchs, thereby lessening his freedom of international political movement, but nevertheless extending his country a timely economic lifeline when it was most desperately needed. Resultantly, it should come as no surprise that Egypt is a party to the Saudi-led war on Yemen, in support of Riyadh's isolation of Qatar in the Gulf Cold War, and on unfriendly terms with Muslim Brotherhood-backing Turkey. Of pertinence, Cairo is suspicious of Ankara's agreement with Khartoum to redevelop the Sudanese Red Sea island of Suakin, perceiving it to be a clever form of strategic encirclement that dovetails with Ethiopia's controversial construction of the Grand Renaissance Dam, which Egypt fears will place it in the position of hydrological and therefore existential dependency on Addis Ababa if it's ever completed. Despite its rich history and enormous population, modern-day Egypt has lost its Cold War-era luster as a secular Arab leader because of its peace treaty with Israel and financial strategic alliance with the Gulf monarchies, both of which considerably limit Cairo's ability to flexibly balance its international partnerships in the new Cold War as needed. This means that President Sisi will never be a new Nasser so long as these political conditions remain in effect as expected. But it shouldn't be ruled out that Egypt will become a more important great power in general under his continued leadership, even if the reasons for this are geopolitical ones largely beyond his personal control and part of the inevitable global transition to a multipolar world order. Alrighty folks, well this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program, and I hope you all listen again next week. Thanks, have a nice weekend, and bye!